Welcome to the ONC PCOR Research Data Use in Areas Work Group Meeting Number 12. My name is Hilda and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants' lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your lines. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and wish to ask a question, please announce yourself on the phone, stating your name and affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. I will now like to turn the call over to Priscilla Dulac.
Thanks, Hilda. So good afternoon, everyone, and I guess good morning to the folks on the West Coast. So this is actually our last meeting with everyone together on the call, but I'm sure you'll be hearing from us outside of this meeting as well. My name is Priscilla, and joining me from the NORC team, we have Lauren Harvey, Gagan Jindal, and Catherine Donaldson. Joining us from GW, we have Jane Thorpe, Lara Cartwright-Smith, and Elizabeth Gray. And then we also have Joanna Singerano and Daniela Mika. From ONC, we have Helen Tatum-Peters and Debbie Massa. And I see that we actually have a pretty good participation of a number of you that have participated in some of our previous calls. So, you know, we look forward to having a lively discussion with you this afternoon. So for the agenda for today, we actually are going to be presenting, one of the last scenarios that we've worked on, and this is focused on combining data for PCOR. Specifically, we've worked on looking at some considerations when you combine birth records with claims data. And so Daniela will walk us through that. And then we are going to sort of move into sort of some of the use case analysis that we've continued to do with each of these scenarios that we've been discussing with you. So Joanna will walk us through a brief overview of use case one, which focuses on combining data for PCOR, so we're, you know, we're combining data in the absence of consent. And then we will focus the rest of the time on the use case analysis that we have been doing with respect to patient-generated health data. And then we will wrap up the call with some sort of important next steps and how we will continue to sort of engage with you outside of these calls. Okay? So I guess with that, I'm going to move us along. And Daniela, I'm going to hand it over to you now to walk us through the scenario. Okay? Daniela?
Thanks. So this is another scenario in the theme of combining data sets from different independently managed organizations, and the focus of this one is combining claims data and birth records. But I think that you could also generalize the kinds of concepts we're trying to model here with other kinds of public data sets like death records. So the approach here is fairly similar to what we've discussed in the past, bringing together administrative claims databases from private insurers. However, the challenge that the researcher is facing in this case is getting better information on things like gestational age and the location of birth, which might be very useful for prenatal and pregnancy-related research. So, in the absence of collecting any clinical data or contacting patients directly, there is an interest in trying to obtain the birth records. So while the researcher has IRB approval from her home institution, the only way to link the data from the birth records with the claims data is by using these unique IDs that we've spoken about in the past. There's a lot of barriers that need to be overcome here that are different between state to state policy on birth certificate data that we would like to hear your thoughts on today if you've had experience with birth certificate data, and that would also any experience you have with things like death data too that's curated by states. And additionally, there's some state laws that only allow Department of Health staff to perform the linkages, which often introduces significant delays as well as as well as some resource constraints. And this is something that we've also encountered with trying to link mental health records with records from claims and clinical databases. So these kinds of policies are things we'd like to hear about from you. And finally, there's some questions about whether or not the research team can assume any responsibility for the linkages and obtain the necessary waivers and approvals for that. So we could scroll down to the specific questions that we'd like to get your thoughts on today. Were you wondering if there's any other state laws that you may be aware of that would be barriers in this case and similar cases? And if there's any patient privacy concerns associated with state health departments performing the linkage versus researchers doing the linkage, and whether there's any ethical considerations that might be important to think about in this case if they're outside of the privacy concerns. And then what kind of assurances can be provided to payers about the risks of sharing identifiable information? And we've spoken a little bit about this in the past, but this is also a different type of party where we're thinking about state health departments and payers collaborating together for the purposes of research as opposed to multiple payers or payers in clinical organizations. So I think if we scroll down, most of the sort of grid information here is very much what you would expect. There's also some alternatives that I thought we'd get your thoughts on if you've had this experience before, which is linkages with all payer claims databases or HIEs, and what to do if the data use agreements, business associate agreements, or studies expire in these kinds of scenarios. And what information system requirements might be for systems that are managed that are responsible for combining these kinds of data sets. So I think with that we can open it up to hear from you guys about what your experiences and thoughts are in these kinds of cases.
Thanks, Daniela.
Where is the IRB located if the researchers are from insurance and public health departments? Where is the IRB?
I think this is an issue that has come up before, and I think that the researchers' activities are governed by whatever their home institution's IRB is or whatever the designated IRB is. However, the record release and the disclosures would be governed by the data holders, privacy board, or other designated board, and that could be an IRB, an internal IRB, or it could be a third party. And that's to my knowledge, that's the way things have worked with covered entities. I don't know if anybody has experience with state public health systems and how they tend to manage things. I know in California, we do have a review board that would be called on to do these kinds of releases.
So this is Leslie Francis. I just wanted to make two ethical comments about this. First of all, birth certificates are not necessarily the kind of thing people would think of as health records. So the kind of repurposing that's involved in their use is possibly something that raises a different set of ethical questions than using medical records to improve labor and delivery. The second thing is that if you compare the newborn screening discussions where the real rubber has hit the road has been about retention of samples, and this is an area in which, you know, there's no way you can not have your birth certificate information retained. It's, you know, critical for everything from a passport to whatever. So it does seem to me that the kinds of ethical issues that get raised here and the outcry about retained blood spots in newborn screening might be another reason just to wave a caution flag ethically here based on people's attitudes.
Thanks. I know Kevin has his hand up. Kevin, did you want to go ahead and make a comment or question?
Sure. So this is Kevin Haynes with HealthCore, a research subsidiary of Anthem. Sentinel has linked administrative claims data to nearly every birth registry in the country, including, you know, New York and then New York City and all of the different permutations of that. Under the auspices of public health, and those white papers are all available online. I'll send links to both Daniela and Priscilla following the meeting. Regarding the IRB question, if we were to do the same activity under research, we would go through our central IRB, which has also been designated the authority to grant the waiver of authorization, at least from our data perspective. Obviously, if Mac's researcher came to us with their own IRB, that would be a great first step, but I think we would still have to go through our central IRB because it would govern the privacy considerations. I'm not sure what the individual health departments would need in response to outside of the activity of public health surveillance, but that would be a easy reach out to some of these contacts at the state registries for that query.
I wonder if the legal team might be able to comment on whether the approach of a researcher bringing their IRB to a third party covered entity is something that is legally required for an internal designated IRB to review, or is that just a norm? I think that most of our experiences have been that even if there is a third party IRB, there seems to also be an internal review. But I wasn't clear if this is just a normative behavior, if this is actually legally required.
This is Marisa in OCR. So the privacy rule doesn't require that any particular IRB be responsible for reviewing a request to waive authorization.
This is Leslie Francis just commenting on why it happens that a lot of institutions require it. Institutions have different views about what's okay. And that's been a huge set of controversies. Some of that's taken up in the NPRM, actually, because it can put such a burden on researchers. On the other hand, some institutions want to have much stronger informed consent requirements, for example, than others.
Thanks, guys. That's really helpful.
This is Karen Rothenberg. I just agree with what Leslie said, and I think it's a protection on all ends. Prudent.
Hello, this is Priscilla. Sorry, was that Leslie Rothenberg?
That was Karen Rothenberg.
I'm sorry, Karen Rothenberg. So, Karen, can you make your comment again? So I'm not sure we quite heard it.
I just was agreeing basically with what Leslie said. And
sure.
Your point about is it required or is it, you know, a state law thing or is it just a question of culture?
Mm-hmm.
I think we're basically having all three of us had a consistent answer to that. I don't know about any state law specifically addressing this.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't. This is Leslie again. I don't know of any state laws addressing it either. I think it's institutional policy.
This is Janet D.W. That's certainly been our experience as well. It varies by institution, and it's sort of protection, sort of internal protection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 'Cause especially when you're dealing with controversial stuff.
Any other comments or questions? Dennis, did you have any other follow-up on this?
No, although I think that the early point that was brought up about other cases where there might be some biosample issues associated with birth records might be an opportunity for us to kind of dig deeper into what's been happening in that domain and how that might relate to other work that's happening. So I'll try to dig more into anything that has been published around that.
Okay. So Priscilla,
could I just clarify one of the points in the use case that Max must destroy the data 2 years after the end of the active collection phase? Is this something that is typical? Is it simply envisioned in this use case? Is it something that this project would urge? Could you just talk about that for a minute?
So Daniela, do you want to handle that? Yeah.
Sure. I can speak to this to a certain extent. At least in the past, it's been fairly common for record destruction to be one of the ways in which privacy and confidentiality is protected. One example is in our electronic IRB system, we have a number of choices that we can select around what we'll be doing to protect confidentiality, and record destruction is one of those options, though not required. And any given IRB might evaluate a protocol and the associated risks in order to signal whether or not destruction was something that should be required. This particular case may not merit it, but some of the other ones that we've discussed might, and that brings to mind, the scenario with people coming in and out of incarceration, where the records might actually introduce some kind of a risk if they were to the participants. So my experience has been that it's not an uncommon way of specifying these things, although obviously I think it's discouraged, especially now with the value of data reuse.
I guess I would ask if it's a criterion for an IRB to require this, how is that monitored? Is it and something automated built into the protocol that as of a certain date all the data disappears or not? How is this monitored?
This is Kevin at HealthCore, and a few times that we have created data sets to provide to researchers for them to do linkage. So Max researchers, if you will, who call us, we've written into our data use agreements these provisions of data destruction. How we follow up on making sure that the data has been destroyed is not well defined. As a matter of fact, sometimes we learn that research is still going on data that is now outside of a purviewed contract, and at least that gives us some credence to go back to that institution's IRB or our IRB and say, that data can't be used anymore. So I understand Daniela's position where it's going to be hard when we want to do data transparencies and, accumulate data for future unknown research needs. But at the same time, when you're doing these linkages and recognizing and understanding the privacy issues that you want to limit the use of the data to a 3-year term or a 2-year term so that, the data is not living in perpetuity, on people's servers as you have staffing changes and all of these other things. There is still that desire to have a data destruction clause in our data use agreements, and some of that then translates over to the, conditions and provisions that we set forth in an IRB.
I really appreciate that, and I guess my feeling would be, given the sensitivity of at least the kind of data that we're talking about in this use case, that data destruction after X years, I would think, should be done, and at least a question raised about accountability for doing that. I don't have any proposal about how to accomplish the monitoring, but I think there's got to be accountability here if people are accessing records that a normal consumer would never dream are being aggregated or collected or being sent anywhere.
Thank you for raising the point. You know, so one of the things that we will be doing that I'll talk to a little bit later is, as part of these discussions that we're having with you, we sort of, you know, distilling requirements or suggestions, you know, which we'll put forward, you know, focused on each of these use cases. So thanks for raising the point. Other comments or questions? I'm going to move us along, and Ioana, I think we're going to sort of tee up the conversation just coming out of this with the discussion on use case one. So I'm going to hand it over to you, okay? Ioana, you?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. So they're just bring up use case one. I think you can do sort of a brief overview of this, and then we can move on to the PGHD use case.
That's right. So use case one actually is describes the requirements implied by the scenario we just looked at, the combining of claims and birth records. But as we discussed in previous calls, it's a more generic look at all the necessary data use agreement prerequisites and information flows that are necessary to combine data from multiple sources and make it available to researchers. So let's go to the next slide and take another look at the use case analysis. So these are all the various activities, use cases, goals that are involved in combining data sets for PCOR. And last time we discussed the creation of a multi-site research identifier. That's a very important element. We're also putting forth here an architecture that requires a coordinating center, mitigate and broker the exchange between the research institution and all the data sites that have information relevant to that research. The prerequisites that we discussed also related to the agreements that have to be in place. And I would say, what I heard from today's call is a requirement for the data use agreement to include provisions to how the data is destroyed after the end of the research. We have in our workflow identified the fact that after the end of the research, the data sites are not supposed to supply additional information to the researcher unless there is some sort of grace period that allows the researcher to make some corrections and adjustments to their results based on refreshed information. But there will be clear clauses in the data use agreement to identify the responsibilities of the data sites in relation to the data and also the responsibilities of the research organization in relation to that same data. So we'll make sure to record these requirements for future analysis in CLIN too. Another thing I wanted to identify here is the necessity to involve the IRB and the site compliance office in the creation of the agreements and approving the protocol. That would also have any other requirements related to administration of a consent if a consent is required. In this particular use case, we're assuming that data does not require a consent from the patient or an authorization to disclose on behalf of the data sites. Next slide.
Could you comment on the coordinating center? Maybe I missed that in a previous meeting, but who is that and where is it going to be and how is it funded and what's going on with that?
Daniela would describe the coordinating center as an honest broker. It is not mandatory, obviously, to support this sort of use case, but we are assuming in this scenario. And I think, Daniela, you can speak more to this from your own experience. We're assuming the center is a trusted broker of data. It's not storing any data, but is enabling the exchange of standard-based data between the researcher and the data sites. Daniela, do you want to explain more about what your assumptions are of a funding and operation of this coordinating center?
Sure. I mean, I think this can also be a little bit loaded, so it's good that you're bringing it up. In this case, we are assuming that there is a trusted third party. We're calling it a coordinating center in this diagram, but you could easily label it an honest broker or a trusted broker, somebody that has been resourced in order to fulfill the needs of a particular project. In many cases, when we're working with research networks that have these kinds of complex interactions, there is a coordinating center that has been funded by the funding agency with this particular role. I think that also probably the NORC team can talk about when they've been in this role, and possibly others on the call as well. So this is usually funded by a convening group, although it's occasionally funded by the institutions themselves, but usually that's in my limited experience, usually that's for operational purposes rather than for purposes of actually conducting research under a federally funded project.
And just to clarify, our assumption in this case is that this is in the category of enabling technology or enabling facilities rather than an active participant in research. So that's a very, very important distinguishing characteristic.
I think that the concept, this is Lucy Johns, by the way, I think the concept of enabling elements is very important for the whole conceptualization of doing research. So I don't know if you have a list anywhere, but the idea of a coordinating center that outsiders could see as, say, a place to go to ask questions or a place to look to for standardized governance of protocols or exchanges or whatever, and potentially to play a broker, as you said, a broker role among competing organizations. It seems to me really interesting, and I also like the idea that this, what did I just call it,
coordinating center. Yeah, I had trouble with that too.
Yeah, the coordinating element would create the identifiers. I mean, creating identifiers is something that someone who doesn't understand all this can easily focus on. How am I going to be identified for this work or that project that I read about in the newspaper or heard about on TV? If some kind of third party is involved that might project an aura of trustworthiness that might not necessarily be perceived if institutions, which have certainly a research and potentially a financial interest in the outcome of the research, if they were doing that. So I like the idea, and maybe you could highlight this in your final report, that there's a category of things that we call enabling elements, and this is one of them.
And I think you're also placing this coordinating center at the core of some type of ethical behavior that they could also not just enable technology and exchange, and that's where we focus primarily on information exchange, identity cross-referencing, that sort of thing. I think you're also putting it somewhere in the middle of, you know, enabling an ethical community and making that a very transparent process.
Yes. Yes, definitely. The whole, it embodies an understanding that trust should be a characteristic of all this data exchange.
And I have to say, as an engineer, I also see the value of having this sort of regional resource as a means of short-circuiting some of these startup needs of a new research protocol or study. If there is an established mechanism for establishing a multi-site unique identifier for research, then there's no need for everyone to reinvent a new algorithm, for instance.
This does enable scaling, definitely.
Right, yeah. So it does support some economies of scale and some and reduces some of the rework required to set up a new study. So we'll make a note of that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I think Kevin wants to ask something. Kevin, is that right? Did you have something that you wanted to ask? Okay, maybe not.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so this is a great discussion. I think that, you know, if you substitute in for CoreNet here to all of this, which is sort of the elephant in the room, right, when you look at the coordinating center, this puts a lot of power into somebody like Duke and Harvard to do this. But that's on a nationwide level. I like what you just said about regional, which then if you look to the CDRN type model, that gives them a lot of power. And I don't know, I love how scalable this may be, but I also assess the fragmentation of this. So from some nationwide insurer like an Anthem, is this then setting up the development of 14, 18, 19, 22, 200 different strategies of having to deal with identifiers, regional identifiers, local identifiers for individual study projects? And I think that that's a major barrier. And then additionally, some folks come to insurers for research, and an insurer just needs deeper clinical data to answer the question. And sometimes researchers come from academic medical centers or other places that have clinical data but need longitudinal data. And so having this coordinator center approach, though, while it strengthens the fact that it's a centralized model, but who is that coordinating center? And then is there multiple coordinating centers, within a region, nationally? I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions.
I don't think we're planning to answer them. I think we're just trying to identify that if such an enabling technology or entity is available, that these are the functions it's intended to supply. I think the kind of governance issues you're asking are very legitimate. But I think we probably will be recording them as questions and something to be further refined and cleaned too, whether this is a statewide or a regional New England center or a national center. I don't think we have the answer here, but to say that if it exists, whether it's scoped, you know, the scope of, you know, New England states or, you know, the southern states, it will fulfill certain responsibilities, and that I think that would be probably as far as we will plan to go in CLIN 1.
I'm sorry, I think Jason has his hand up, and then I think it was Leslie. Leslie, you can go after Jason. Jason, why don't you go ahead?
Sure, so I just wanted to say I think Lucy's idea is fantastic, and it's really a radical idea. That, you know, it goes back to all sorts of basic privacy issues. You know, Amazon will call me if someone's using my credit card, but they won't tell me how they're using my data and who's using my data, you know, of my shopping experience or whatever. So, this idea of redefining or extending the definition of a coordinating center to include sort of registering and understanding who's doing what with whose data is very interesting, and it adds transparency. It would allow patients to be able to research or find out if their data is being used, and, you know, it would all have to be worked out. I don't see it as a power broker situation. I see it as a trust broker type of structure, and I think it would really add a high level of trust and transparency to the research process. I think that, in addition, researchers already register for things like clinicaltrials.gov. they could register their data sets in a way that if someone was interested, the coordinating center could go back to the researcher and find out, you know, if a particular person's data were being used. I really like this idea. I think it's fantastic.
So you're basically seconding the idea that it's not just a technology enabling element, but it's also an ethical and privacy enabling element, and an empowering element that gives
participants
some visibility into the process.
Right, coordinating centers right now are functioning simply to coordinate use of data for research. And a lot of the tensions on the call, the dilemmas that we've come up with today have to do with, lack of consistent rules across IRB, lack of clarity as to how data should be used. And so one solution to that we're not going to solve those problems, but we could improve trust and improve transparency of what's going on by having one place coordinate uses and registration of where data are, how they're being used, et cetera. I think it's really good.
Thanks, Jason.
If I may just add a quick data point, I think the engagement from the participants, engagement from the patients, I think it's something that health information exchanges are also looking, and they've been looked at as enabling technologies for a long time. But they have failed to engage the community in a broad sense without engagement directly from the people benefiting from the use of an HIE, i.e. the patients themselves. So it's kind of interesting to hear this discussion because we hear that discussion in other fora.
Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a good segue to talk about sort of the next use case on patient generated health data. Before we do that, was there another comment? Leslie, did you want to make another comment before we move on?
I'm sorry, are you talking to me?
No, I was talking to Leslie. I thought Leslie had another comment.
Okay.
But perhaps not. Yeah. Okay. Do we want to talk about the CGHD? We have about 20 minutes.
As far as the workflow is concerned, again, we can revisit that at the end of the call if necessary. But as far as the data use, combining data for PCOR, the workflow diagram, I think there's nothing new under the sun here. We're just giving you a sense of how that coordinating center works from an information brokering standpoint. I think that's the main takeaway of this slide. That the coordinating center links the researchers to a variety of data sites, and it does it in a way that is seamless to both ends of exchange. And basically the big requirement here that we're expecting a great deal from information exchange. We're expecting standards to be available. We're expecting systems to be interoperable. So we have a high level of requirements from the information systems involved in operationalizing this workflow. So let's go to the next use case, the patient-generated health data. I don't know if Daniela would like to introduce this, but we've considered several scenarios under the rubric of patient-generated health data, and the first scenario we elaborated is the use of sensor data for PCOR, and primarily we're looking at a situation where an employer-based program is set up to monitor the activity level of employees. And if we can go to the next slide, we can see the various entities involved in this. We assume two very options for the management of the consent in relation to this type of research. The employer is at the core of motivating the actors in this particular use case. And in one situation, the employee would consent to the vendor who supplies the medical devices, the sensors that are used to track activity. And in a second version, we are expecting the employee to supply that consent directly to the employer. So in both cases, though, The outcome of the data collection is to supply information to the researcher to analyze the activity data and the effectiveness of the program set up by the employer. Danielle, is there anything you'd like to add here to qualify the type of research that would be done with this data?
No, I think it's best to go through the use cases, and then maybe we can pull,
okay.
pull in some additional comments.
So again, the second diagram, as you can see here, identifies the employer and the employee involved in the creation of the consent. And the workflow diagram shows you how the employer is the main broker in exchanging information between the vendor who aggregates activity data from the sensors worn or used by the employees. So can we go to the next slide?
Can I just ask a quick question? Could you go back to that slide, please?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to clarify that none of the actors in this diagram is covered by HIPAA. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So now we're talking about personal health information, which is not governed by HIPAA, which is collected by something and administered and sent out for research and so forth. And HIPAA is not at issue here. So how are privacy and security, how do they enter into the discussion of these use cases that we're now talking about?
So what we've done here is we've described how the researcher makes use of the data, how data is collected and aggregated and shared using the employer as an intermediary. Any sort of issues related to the ethical use of this data, I think, would be falling out of CLIN 2. And you are correct in a sense that we are in uncharted territory, and that's where we would probably be looking to our colleagues at GW to provide some guidance. So right now we are making some common sense assumptions that, you know, either directly through the employer or directly to the vendor managing this program, the patient agrees to the sharing of their data with a researcher.
So,
but you are correct. It's not an explicit HIPAA.
An alert in fine print on these use cases that HIPAA does not govern any of these transactions. Just to alert somebody that
mm-hmm.
privacy and security are questions to be raised here, and they're not answered in this sequence of slides, right? Just to alert people.
This is Marisa in OCR. I just wanted to check on something. I'm trying to recall, is the employer offering the wellness program in conjunction with a health plan? Because then HIPAA would come into play.
I don't believe in this case we had any reference to the health plan. This is something that the employer is offering on their own accord, on their own initiative. And they're just leveraging the information to evaluate the effectiveness of the program, the wellness programs they've established.
Okay. Thanks.
But maybe that will be an alternative scenario that we should, you know, certainly. Yeah.
Right, but I think it would be a significantly different scenario because different
mm-hmm.
rules would apply in that case. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And I think this is a round of the conversation. Here we are raising the questions and issues because there's clearly some gap areas. And the point of
right.
this conversation is to say that things are happening today and what type of framework should be in place so that, you know, data gets used responsibly. So I'll stop there, Joanna. Let me let you continue, okay?
Sure, yeah. So just quickly going over the workflow, our assumption in this information exchange data use scenario is that the data is flowing. If we can go to the next slide. Sorry. We are assuming that the information is collected by the vendor, and it is made available to the employer systems for management. So they are the main broker of this information that is provided by the vendor managing the wellness program. And the information is then exchanged with the researcher for the purposes of conducting effectiveness and patient-centered outcome research for this particular program. So again, it's the employer is involved, and they broker the relation, the interaction between, or the information gathering and collection from the vendor who supplies and or manages the sensors and medical devices used to track the employer's activity. And I believe this is the last slide we had for this use case. So if there are any other questions related to alternatives, maybe this is a good time to discuss them. We have a whole 12 minutes.
This so, thank you. We could study these for hours.
Well, but on that note, I mean,
I think one of the charges that we have is, you know, in these workflow diagrams and others, you know, we need to try and make them as sort of accessible and understandable as possible. So to the extent that, you know, you have some feedback on areas of clarification or ways in which we can pass this out, you know, we would be very open to input. So, Ioana, go ahead. You had a comment.
No, I didn't have a comment. No, entertaining questions.
I think Jason has a question. Go ahead, Jason.
Hi.
Jason, can you
I guess my comment, yeah, I am here. So Lucide asked about HIPAA, and I think one thing we may need to consider is that a lot of these employers who are collecting this type of patient-generated data are doing so as part of a larger workplace wellness program that often links data to data that do fall under HIPAA, and that may have to be represented here somehow. Anyway, that's just the point.
So, could you help us a little bit more? So, you're saying is that in this particular case, we are assuming the data is used to evaluate the effectiveness of the program itself. I think what you're referring to is other situations in which the employer may be using the activity data to say to the employer, maybe you're not doing enough to correct your fitness issues, and therefore you may or may not be entitled to some incentives around your, right? So, and I think that would be different, and because that was the very first question I asked of Daniela. How does this relate to other incentives that employers may have if you, let's say, join a gym and show up twice a week? And this is not that. It's actually research for the purposes of evaluating the program itself.
Oh, okay. I was more referring to a situation where, I mean, because this is all ties back to cost. So, you know, the employer knows that they have, they lose so many days of work to back pain, and they know that because their employees have been visiting doctors and gotten a diagnosis of back pain. And so they start a back health program and or an exercise program at work, and then they go to some sort of claims company and they get a cut of data from, you know, the health plan that they support, and they find out if they've reduced the number of back episodes, and then their wellness program is paying off. So, I mean, that's what I was referring to.
Okay. So if this is tied in to other kinds of information, it may affect how much out-of-pocket employers have to pay for their health insurance, presumably, right?
Right. Yeah. Right, exactly. And that's why they do the programs, not out of the goodness of their hearts, but...
Well, you know, healthy employees, happy employees, productive employees.
True.
But Daniela, do you want to add something to that? Is there a nuance in here that we can capture that says, you know, some of this information produced by the researcher could feed back into how the employers manages their health insurance? And
yeah, I mean, I think that one of the reasons why we made this scenario as complicated as it is to try to dig into some of these issues about whether there might be ethical concerns for how the employer is
using information that they might be doing for internal research that might not be considered academic research, and how that might feed back into things that would actually affect what might be previous or other issues. So this is
now,
intentionally kind of made to capture these kinds of complexities and get feedback from the group on this.
Now, what we could do in here, indeed, is we could add sort of a subsequent use case in which the research data is used by the employer. And I think I may say, I'm going to venture a guess that there are going to be some ethical discussions around the use of this research information and how they use to perhaps apply some additional pressure perhaps on some folks to change their lifestyle, let's say. So that may be, I would say that, you know, this use case is complete as far as doing research. They use the application of that research to make some changes in the workplace, I think, are a separate one in which, you know, and that's something we need to discuss whether that is in scope or not for us. But I would say the most interesting ethical questions would probably come from how the data is applied to patient-centric outcomes.
If there are unions in this workplace, that will be the first topic that comes up.
Right. So there are some items, but again, what I'm wondering out loud is how much that would be in the purview of research, or if that's sort of in the ethical use of research data. That is not covered by HIPAA directly, but has a tangential relationship with HIPAA. So we'll take that item under consideration and discuss it further. Any other questions?
You could do a really nice flowchart called "Does HIPAA Apply?" and then do a whole yes/no chain.
Okay.
If it's a self-insured firm,
mm-hmm.
not working with an off-the-shelf health plan,
mm-hmm.
No, HIPAA does not apply.
Okay.
If it has a health plan as a benefit, then maybe. And if so, where and how? That's definitely a flowchart.
Okay, so we do have actually those flowcharts that you're describing. We call them decision trees, decision flowcharts, in
yeah.
relation to consent and when what policy applies to protect that information. So I think we'll add that in this context too, at least as a discussion springboard for CLIN 2
yeah.
to further refine. And just I think this is an area that's looking for some additional guidance. So we'll include the decision flowchart in here as well as a guide to whether HIPAA may apply. Any other feedback? So now I'll turn it over to Priscilla.
Yep, sounds good. So I know we have 3 minutes left, and you know, in some ways, I think we are a little, well, at least the team here is a little sad that we won't be meeting with you and, you know, with this group and sort of benefiting from these set of conversations. But I wanted to sort of quickly give you a window into, you know, some of the things that may happen in sort of the coming months. So, you know, in the month of May, we are probably going to reach out to some of you individually. To get some additional feedback on scenarios. So a number of you have commented on these scenarios via Confluence. We've already started reaching back out to some of you for questions and clarifications. But I think there's some of these scenarios, you know, that we are looking for, you know, some additional sort of feedback on. So we'll be reaching out to some of you to get to that, you know, level of specificity, okay? The other thing to mention is, you know, we've had this sort of very interesting discussion of unregulated PGHD today. We're probably going to work out a few more scenarios related to PGHD, and I know there's some of you on the call that are very interested in this area, so, you know, we will be again reaching out to you sort of individually to get some thoughts on some of the additional scenarios that are currently underway. And so the other thing is, you know, we've really benefited from a lot of sort of meaningful and thoughtful insights over the last, I want to say like three, 4 months engaging with all of you. And so we've actually started drafting what we call a synthesis document, which brings together all of these you know, individual research data use scenarios that we've discussed with you, as well as, you know, the requirements analysis that we've done that we've sort of instantiated in what we call these use cases. So that document is, you know, being discussed and defined with ONC. And in the month of June, you know, it's our plan to share that synthesis document out with all of you and gather some additional feedback. And, you know, we'll work on sort of specifics in, you know, what would be the most optimum way to get your feedback. So please look out for that from us, okay? And then I think you'll still see some emails coming from Catherine Donaldson on, you know, feedback on sort of these individual scenarios that you all have been so very gracious in providing. So you'll certainly see some of those emails coming out as well. And, you know, the next slide. So we do have this, you know, the Confluence website. All of the information will remain posted and available on the website. I do want to say from the team collectively that we really want to thank all of you for your time and, you know, all of your insights and spending time and providing feedback via Confluence, because I think this whole sort of interaction and dialogue has made for, you know, a lot of interesting issues and requirements that we can raise, which will really be quite important as sort of the CLIN2 activities start getting underway. I'm just going to stop there for a second. And, you know, Helen, I didn't know if ONC wanted to make any other sort of comment now, but I thought I'll just give you an opportunity to, you know, say anything that you may have wanted to say.
Thank you, Priscilla. I would just echo your comments you just made. We are extremely grateful for all of your time over the last several months in being present at these meetings and providing such interesting conversation for us to learn from and to develop our materials from. And then all of the additional time you've put in working off the clock with Priscilla and her team to again provide us the input that we need. We will definitely remain in touch with you. This project is going to run over the course of the next several months and into 2017. So we will be remaining in touch, asking for your feedback at various points and engaging with you to ensure that we are making a truly useful and beneficial product that that will have the uptake that we hope it should have in and among the research community. So thank you so much. We really appreciate your time and look forward to engaging with you again in the future.
Thanks, Helen. Thanks, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.